Contracts used in the real estate business. Virtually all relationships encountered in the real estate industry involve some form of contract. A contract is an agreement to do something, or to refrain from doing something. Contracts may be oral or written. Contracts related to the sale of real estate must generally be in writing to conform to the statute of frauds. Real estate license holders negotiate a relatively wide range of contracts. Some of these contracts are sales and lease agreements between a seller and buyer, or a landlord and tenant. Other contracts relate to brokerage business activities. These contracts include listing agreements with sellers and landlords and buyer representation agreements with buyers and tenants. Many brokers engage in the property management business and enter into property management agreements with landlords. Listing agreements. A listing agreement is an employment agreement between the seller and the broker. In the agreement, the broker agrees to expend his or her best efforts to locate a buyer at a price and terms acceptable to the seller. In most states, including Texas, the listing agreement creates an agency relationship between the seller and the broker. A valid listing agreement must include names and signatures of all of the property's owners and the listing agent. The property description. The list price that was determined by the seller. A definite starting and ending termination date. Broker compensation. The written and signed listing agreement gives the broker actual, written authority to perform specific actions for the principal as listed in the agreement. Elements of a listing agreement. In most states, a broker must provide a seller with certain disclosures prior to entering into a listing agreement. These disclosures often address such issues as agency relationships, brokerage fees, property condition, relationships with buyers, market value of the property being listed, local market conditions. Additionally, a listing agreement should provide the broker with specific authorizations and instructions, including permission to place a sign on the property, permission to place a lockbox on the property, permission to advertise the property on the internet. Other provisions regarding showing times and instructions. The statute of frauds is a body of law requiring certain contracts to be in writing in order to be enforceable. In order to comply with the statute of frauds, most states require that a listing agreement have a specific termination date and be in writing to be enforceable. If the property has not sold, the listing can be renewed before expiration. If the property has not sold, the listing will automatically terminate on the termination date. At that point, the seller is free to relist the property with the same broker, another broker, or no one. The broker's fee is also an essential part of the agreement. The broker's fee is negotiated between the seller and the broker. Fees are not recommended or set by any organization or government agency. The listing agreement also specifies the fee paid to another broker in a cooperative sale. A cooperative sale is one in which one broker lists the property and a different broker sells it. Compensation rates and fees have always been and will always be fully negotiable between client and broker. There is no standard rate of compensation in real estate transactions. Types of listing agreements. The four major types of listing agreements are 1. Exclusive right to sell. Real estate brokers recommend this listing, which grants an exclusive right to sell the property during the listing term. Compensation is paid even if the owner sells the property. Most brokers prefer exclusive right to sell listing agreements, as they give them the highest degree of protection in earning compensation during the listing term. Under an exclusive right to sell, brokers are more willing to spend advertising dollars and their sales efforts to secure a buyer. If the property is listed at market value, this type of listing probably serves the interest of both parties. Under this plan, the broker has sufficient time to test the market, design an advertising sales campaign, and market the property under the best possible terms. Another benefit of the exclusive right to sell listing agreement is that it helps to avoid the problem of procuring cause lawsuits because the listing broker is the only one with the right to sell the property. 2. Exclusive agency. In an exclusive agency listing, the seller agrees to list the property with only one broker during the listing term, with the provision that the seller can personally sell the property without paying an agent's compensation fee. The danger in this listing is that the broker risks collusion between the prospect and the seller, who might conspire to avoid compensation entirely. Perhaps the biggest risk to the broker in an exclusive agency listing is that the seller will not fully cooperate with the broker's efforts. An example is when a seller thinks they can sell to a prospect and avoid paying a fee. Texas Realtors does not have an exclusive agency listing agreement in full, and most brokers do not prefer such an agreement. Instead, Texas Realtors has an addendum that, when completed and attached to an exclusive right to sell agreement, makes that agreement exclusive agency, allowing the seller to sell the property and avoid paying any compensation fees to the broker. Exclusive agency agreements are often used by builders who list their properties with a broker, primarily to expose their properties through the multiple listing service. Builders still maintain the right to sell the property without paying the broker a fee. The broker is only entitled to a payment if the buyer comes from the broker's or cooperating broker's efforts. 3. Open listing. The open listing gives the seller the right to list the property with multiple competing brokers and to sell the property personally without liability for payment of compensation. Some sellers believe that an open listing best serves their interests, and that listing with several brokers produces more prospects than listing with a single brokerage. Real estate brokers recommend against open listings for several reasons. First, the owner may be subject to compensation claims by more than one broker. It is not always possible to easily determine who was responsible for the sale, and controversy over this point may lead to expensive litigation. Secondly, brokers are concerned that because compensation is paid to the broker who first finds the buyer, an open listing does not protect the broker who diligently advertises the property. In fact, who was the procuring cause of the sale? The open listing has resulted in many lawsuits between brokers, each claiming due compensation. These actions are known as procuring cause lawsuits. Because of the possibility the property may be sold without notice by others, brokers are unwilling to spend time and effort on a property for which they have no compensation protection. Lastly, some argue that brokers are incentivized to close the sale quickly and at a lower than market price under an open listing. If this occurs, a broker could be accused of failing to protect the client's, seller's, best interests. Therefore, agent loyalty is a significant issue when listing property using an open listing. And 4. Net listing. Under a net listing, the seller establishes a minimum net amount for his or her proceeds at closing. The real estate broker's compensation is the difference between the minimum net established by the seller and the actual seller's net. The seller could receive less than she would normally receive. Depending on the details of the transaction, the broker could earn more than the seller, or, perhaps, nothing at all. Because of potential ethical and legal issues, these listings are outlawed in many states. In states where the practice is still legal, net listings are discouraged and subject to considerable scrutiny. While net listings are legal in Texas, TREC has recognized the potential for abuse in net listings and has passed two specific rules regarding this type of listing. A broker should take net listings only when the principal insists upon a net listing and when the principal appears to be familiar with the current market values of real property. When a broker accepts a listing, the broker enters into a fiduciary relationship with the broker's principal. The broker is obligated to make diligent efforts to obtain the best price possible for the principal. A net listing places an upper limit on the principal's expectancy, placing the broker's interest above the principal's to obtain the best possible price. Net listings should be qualified to assure the principal of no less than his or her desired price, and to limit the broker to a specified maximum compensation. A real estate license holder is obligated to advise a property owner as to the license holder's opinion of the market value of a property when negotiating a listing or offering to purchase the property for the license holder's own account as a result of contact made while acting as a real estate agent. Multiple listing services. The exclusive right to sell and exclusive agency listing agreements usually call for the broker to place the listing into one or more multiple listing services, MLS. In the multiple listing service, listings of member firms are shared. Sharing the listings increases the inventory of properties for sale among member brokers. Agents also use the shared information to prepare a comparative market analysis, CMA. The agent uses sale information from the MLS data to show a seller the market value of the property. The agent bases this analysis on properties that have recently sold that are most similar to the seller's property. If possible, the agent should use data from sales that have closed within the last 6 months. The more recent the sales data, the better. The agent will also show properties currently listed on the CMA that are similar to the subject property. The listing agent will show expired properties like the subject property on the CMA as well, if such data is available. A rule of thumb is 3-3. Each of recently sold, recently listed, and recently expired properties that are similar to the subject property the agent desires to list. Appraisers also have access to MLS for their use in preparing appraisal reports. Brokers can also use the information from the MLS to create a broker's price opinion, BPO. A BPO is essentially the same as a CMA. Most often requested by an attorney, a relocation company, or even by a lender to be used in a short sale, a BPO amounts to the broker's written opinion of the value of a property. It is not an appraisal. Buyer agency agreements. Historically, buyers were not represented by license holders. The buyer in the transaction was an unrepresented customer, and all brokers in the transaction represented the seller. Over the last 30 years, buyers have become increasingly aware of the benefits of buyer agency representation. In most states, including Texas, buyer agency agreements may be created orally or in writing. However, by far, the best method is to do so in writing. A written buyer agency agreement is explicit regarding the duties and responsibilities of both the buyer and the broker. Note also that intermediary consent must be obtained in writing, which is a problem when representing a buyer under an oral buyer representation agreement. Sometimes license holders might be in the habit of representing buyers under an oral agreement, then later move to a written buyer representation agreement in order to obtain intermediary consent. Oral agreements are not enforceable against the client, but are enforceable against the agent. An agent should take care when moving from an oral agreement to a written one, because the terms of the written agreement may conflict with the oral agreement with the buyer. When written provisions conflict with oral provisions, the written ones virtually always prevail. Confusion and misunderstanding over oral and written agreements will undoubtedly result in an unhappy buyer client. Like the listing agreement, the buyer representation agreement is an employment contract. In order to collect compensation, brokers must prove that they were employed to sell the property. Even though a broker may have been influential in executing the sale, the broker is not entitled to compensation unless they were employed. All listing and buyer representation agreements must be in writing to be enforceable. If a broker sells a property on an oral listing agreement, the broker is considered by the courts to have freely volunteered services. Like the listing agreement with a seller, the buyer-tenant representation agreement should be in writing. Elements of a buyer representation file should include the following: general characteristics of the property search, market area, buyer's and broker's obligations, term of the agreement, broker's duties to clients and customers, compensation agreement, consent for the broker to represent other buyers, fair housing language, signatures of the parties, and intermediary consent. Benefits of buyer-agency relationships. In the past, buyer representation was rare. Sellers were clients, and buyers were customers. Over time, buyers have discovered the benefits of representation, including access to market data. While some of the data in MLSs is accessible to the public, the majority of it is not. Investment analysis. If the property is going to be rented or held for appreciation or development. Assistance in culling unsuitable properties. Buyers will waste time looking at neighborhoods and properties that do not fit their criteria. Assistance in obtaining financing. Buyer's agents will have several trusted lenders for referral, which is preferable to the random selection of a lender. Assistance with negotiations. The buyer's agent stands between the seller and buyer, which allows the buyer to contemplate offers and counteroffers. Assistance in preparing offers and negotiating strategies. Assistance with surveys, inspections, repairs, and many of the details that must be taken care of in order to close a sale. Buyers who do not sign a representation agreement with an agent are considered customers. Though customers are not receiving the benefits of a buyer agency agreement with a broker, license holders still owe specific duties to them, including honest dealing. An agent may not deceive, defraud, or otherwise dishonestly deal with a customer. Reasonable care and skill in performance. An agent will be held to the standards of knowledge, expertise, and ethics that are spelled out in the Texas Real Estate License Act. Disclosure of all material facts. The license holder must disclose all facts that he or she knows of, or should reasonably be expected to know, that materially affect the value of or desirability of the property. Material facts include disclosure of agency, property condition, and environmental hazards. Regardless of representation, all buyers should be provided with an oral or written disclosure of representation at first contact. That disclosure is usually oral when the buyer first calls or visits the office. Whatever the method of contact, personal visit, phone, fax, or email, the notice of representation should be given. Before discussing the needs and wants of the buyer, the agent should provide the buyer with any required agency disclosures. If the buyer is interested in a property that is owned by the listing broker or agent, parent, child, or spouse of the broker or agent, that relationship must also be disclosed. Likewise, if the buyer is an agent, parent, or child of the agent, that relationship must be disclosed as well. Broker employment. When representing a buyer, the seller must clearly understand the fee arrangements between the seller, the buyer, and the agents. Maintaining clarity and compensation is one of the many good reasons to insist upon a written buyer representation agreement. In the Texas residential real estate business, compensation is commonly paid by sellers to the listing broker. The listing broker agrees in the listing agreement to split the fee with a cooperating broker. The fee split is negotiable between the seller and the listing broker. The fee should be generous enough to encourage buyer agents to show the property. The fee split arrangement for buyer's agents is often different from what is offered to subagents. If the listing broker does not allow subagency, the subagency compensation split is 0%. The fee paid to a buyer's agent varies and is often one half of the total fee paid to the listing broker. Fee splitting arrangements are often established by virtue of membership in the local multiple listing service, MLS. By posting the listing in MLS, a listing broker is offering to split the fee according to the terms of the listing agreement and the broker's membership agreement. Brokers working with non-MLS brokers should contact the listing broker and enter into a fee-sharing agreement before showing the property to the potential buyer. While the broker information section of TREC promulgated contracts contains information regarding a fee split, it is not a fee-splitting agreement with the listing broker because brokers are not parties to the contract. The exception to this rule is the TREC promulgated farm and ranch contract, which does contain a fee-splitting agreement. In any event, all parties and agents need to be aware of representation and which party is responsible for the payment of a fee. Sued for compensation. Only a broker may earn compensation, and only a broker may sue to collect compensation. The broker may sue a seller who has defaulted on a listing agreement or a buyer who has defaulted on a buyer's representation agreement. If a broker seeks to enforce payment of compensation, the following requirements must be satisfied. The broker must have an employment agreement with a promise to pay compensation, signed by the party to be charged. Usually, the seller. The broker must hold a valid real estate license, The broker must be the procuring cause of the sale. The broker must provide a ready, willing, and qualified buyer who agrees to the sale terms required by the seller. The buyer may not be under duress. The license holder must have informed the purchaser in writing to have the abstract examined by an attorney, or the buyer should be furnished with a title policy. Procuring cause of sale. Most litigation over the payment of real estate compensation arises from disputes over who was the procuring cause of sale. The procuring cause of sale is the individual who, through a series of uninterrupted activities or actions, brought about the completion of a contract. The rule is that the broker must perform within the time specified in the contract. It should be added that compensation does not rest on the amount of work completed by a competing broker. Instead, it is a question of who has performed the agency to find a ready, willing, and able buyer. The determination of procuring cause is quite tricky and is dependent on the court's interpretation of the circumstances of the transaction and the actions of the parties involved. Termination of listing agreements and buyer representation agreements. Since listing agreements and buyer representation agreements are employment contracts by which agents are expected to perform certain duties for the principal, they will automatically terminate on the termination date agreed upon in the contract. They will also terminate when the purpose of the contract has been fulfilled, i.e., the agent sells the house per the listing agreement. Listing agreements and buyer representation agreements can also be terminated by abandonment by the broker, revocation by the principal, mutual consent, mutual rescission, acts of law, bankruptcy of the seller or broker, foreclosure, death of the principal or broker, death of the sales agent does not terminate the agreement, destruction of the property or condemnation under eminent domain, change in zoning/property use, compensation rates. Compensation rates and any other means by which sellers and buyers compensate brokers are always negotiable between the parties. Any attempt by a group of brokers to set compensation rates in their area or between a group of brokerage firms would be considered illegal price fixing. As mentioned in Chapter 2, the federal laws that have the most significant impact in this area are the Sherman Antitrust Act and the Clayton Act. The Sherman Antitrust Act is very specific concerning this violation. Property management agreements. Another type of contract used in the real estate business is the property management agreement. The management agreement will specify the responsibilities and tasks the property manager is expected to complete for a property owner. The management agreement is the property manager's employment contract. The management agreement creates a fiduciary relationship, meaning that property managers owe the same fiduciary duties to their clients that sales agents owe to their buyer and seller clients. Obedience, loyalty, disclosure, confidentiality, accounting, and reasonable care. Old car. These duties are the minimum requirements of any relationship. A written property management agreement between the property owner and the brokerage should include the duties and responsibilities of the property manager and the property owner, the management term, when the agreement begins and ends, a detailed description of the property written when the property manager firm takes over management duties, policies and procedures for repair of the property. The management agreement will dictate a large part of the relationship by setting the owner's expectations regarding roles and channels of communication. It is also a good indicator of how involved or uninvolved the owner will be. The management agreement not only delineates the duties of the property manager to the owner, but also includes the fee schedule or pricing schedule, according to which the owner will pay the property manager. Just as there are different ways to calculate a broker's compensation on a sale, percentage of sales price, flat fee, there are fee schedules that determine how a property manager is paid. The traditional approach to management fees is to take a percentage of the rent for the services offered. This percentage is in the vicinity of 8 to 10%, though there is no established industry. Standard fees will vary up or down based on the market in which the property is located. Not all percentage-based fee agreements are the same. There is a marked difference between management agreements that state fees as a percentage of the gross monthly rents, potential, scheduled rents, and the rent collected. Owners will prefer the language in the agreement to read as a percentage of rent collected. Paying a flat fee may seem more palatable for owners than being charged a high percentage of their monthly rental income. The flat fee pricing model will appeal to some owners because it is a known quantity every month. Many companies offer the same rate, no matter how many properties they manage for the owner. Some companies may even lower the monthly rate if the owner brings more properties online. Many property managers shy away from the flat fee model because it does not take into account the actual size of the property and associated amenities. If the monthly rate is the same, no matter the size of the property and the scope of work required to manage it effectively, the PM could be severely undercharging the client. Many property managers will charge their clients other fees related to the management of the property, including leasing fees, fees in the event of a sale, service fees, administrative fees, fees for legal proceedings, usually evictions, interest collected on trust accounts, fees from pet rent and pet deposits, among others. All additional fees charged on top of the basic monthly maintenance fee must be negotiated upfront and included in the management agreement, signed by both parties. A professional property manager would never decide to charge an additional $15 fee on top of an invoice without already having the agreement in place. If these fees are explicitly written into the contract and the client signs it, then they agree to compensate the property manager as addressed in the contract. Management agreements will vary based on the type of property managed. Retail properties are very different from apartment complexes. For this reason, many property management companies will have their management agreements created by an attorney. TREC does not promulgate any property management agreements. However, Texas Realtors does have the Texas Realtors Residential Leasing and Property Management Agreement, TXR 2201, and the Texas Realtors Commercial Property Management Agreement, TXR 2202, available for their members. Leasing real estate. The fourth type of contract used in real estate is the lease. A lease is an agreement that transfers the right to possess a property for a period. The owner of the property is known as the landlord. The lease agreement refers to the landlord as the lessor. A property owner leases real estate in anticipation of income from the tenant. The rental income stipulated by the parties in a lease is known as contract rent. Sometimes the rental amount in a lease is below market rates. The rent the property could currently command on the open market is known as economic rent. If the contract rent is less than the economic rent, the tenant may face a rent increase at the next renewal of the lease. In most states, leases over a specific duration must be in writing to comply with the statute of frauds. Requiring that all leases be in writing protects the interests of both the landlord and tenant. While most commercial and residential leases are in writing, oral agreements are often used in agriculture for farming and grazing. In Texas, a lease for more than 1 year must be in writing to comply with the statute of frauds. Leasehold estates. A leasehold estate gives one possession and use of a property without ownership. The person giving the use, the owner, landlord, is the lessor during the life of a lease. The owner of the freehold estate is held to have a reversionary interest in the property. That means possession will revert or come back to him at the end of the lease. The person acquiring the use, the tenant, is the lessee. There are four types of leasehold estates. 1. Estate for years, a lease with a definite beginning date and definite ending date. The lease period does not have to be for years. The criteria is a specific starting and ending date, which could be a lease for a week, a month, 1 year, or 10 years. The key is the preset period. This lease survives the death of either the landlord or the tenant. It also survives the sale of the property. Notice to terminate is not required, as the lease has a termination date. 2. Periodic tenancy or periodic estate, a lease that renews itself automatically for like periods. Typical examples would be a month-to-month or a week-to-week lease. Usually, this is a lease for an undetermined period with no preset termination date. This lease requires notice to terminate. Sometimes an estate for years will state that if a tenant remains after the termination date, the lease will become a periodic tenancy on a month-to-month basis. It also survives the death of either party and the sale of the property. But since it is easily terminated by notice, this is not usually a problem. 3. Tenancy at sufferance is an interest in leased property created when the holdover tenant, one whose lease has ended and who refuses to leave, is occupying the leased property against the owner's will. The holdover tenant is not paying rent. The only thing that differentiates him or her from a trespasser is his or her former right to occupy the property. A landlord with a holdover tenant has the right to evict this tenant. This process would occur under the forcible entry and detainer statutes. If the holdover tenant pays rent and the landlord accepts that rent, then the interest becomes a holdover tenancy, which is sometimes considered a periodic estate. 4. Tenancy at will or estate at will. A leasehold in which a tenant occupies real estate with the permission of the owner for an uncertain or unspecified length of time. This is a very loose agreement. Depending on the lease agreement, little or no notice may be required, and either party can terminate at any time. However, a specific notice period is usually set. Tenancy at will is the only lease that is easily terminated by the death of the landlord or sale of the property. All other leases would remain in effect and binding on the new owner. Requirements of a valid lease. In most states, for a lease to be valid, it must meet specific minimum requirements, including competent parties, lessor and lessee, let and take agreement, adequate consideration, rent, legal purpose, description of the property, street address is sufficient. Recommendations required for leases greater than 1 year, execution, signed by the parties, term of the lease, duration, 6 months, 1 year, 5 years, etc. Delivery, in writing, if the lease is for more than 1 year. Statute of frauds. Types of leases. Leases can be categorized further by how the consideration or rent is established. In commercial leasing, how rent is paid determines the type of lease. Gross lease. The gross lease is perhaps the simplest of all leases. In a gross lease, the landlord pays costs regularly incurred in ownership, such as taxes, insurance, utilities, and maintenance. The tenant pays only rent. This type of lease is riskier for the landlord because of the possibility of rising costs during the lease term. Net lease. A net lease is one in which, in addition to rent, the tenant pays expenses such as taxes, insurance, and maintenance. A net lease shifts the risk of cost increases from the landlord to the tenant. Net leases are often characterized as net, N, double net, NN, and triple net, NNN. The single net lease, N, is a lease in which the tenant pays rent and property taxes. The landlord is responsible for all other costs associated with the property. The double net lease, NN, is a lease in which the tenant pays rent, property taxes, and property insurance. The landlord is responsible for repairs and maintenance of the building. A triple net lease, NNN, is a lease in which the tenant is responsible for rent and all fixed and variable expenses related to a property, property taxes, property insurance, maintenance. In most cases, the landlord is still responsible for structural repairs. The advantage of a triple net lease to a tenant is that the rent is usually lower than it would be under a gross single net or double net lease. The primary disadvantage to the tenant is that expenses are more variable and harder to anticipate and control. Percentage lease. In the retail environment, a percentage lease obligates the tenant to pay a base rent and a percentage of the gross sales. The percentage may vary depending on the level of sales and will be calculated based on breakpoints in the lease. For example, a tenant may lease 10,000 square feet of space at $10 per foot, $120,000 annually. The monthly rent is then $10,000. If the lease provided for a percentage rent of 4% of gross sales with a breakpoint of $250,000, the tenant would pay additional rent only on monthly sales over $250,000. The percentage rent incentivizes the landlord to build foot traffic in the center with promotions, events, and superior maintenance. A word of caution. Terms such as double net and triple net vary in their meaning from region to region. Within a local market, their meanings may be different. The whole question is complicated by the fact that real estate agents, leasing agents, and landlords use the terms loosely, both in conversation and in marketing materials. Because of these variances, these terms are not strict legal lease definitions. The lease should be read carefully by a competent advisor. The lease terms are determined by the wording of the lease and not by what it is called. Common lease provisions. Leased premises. The lease will describe the actual space being leased. The description will most likely be lot and block if the leased premises include a building and land. If the building is divided into units, the description will be a unit number. Office building descriptions are often described in the manner of 7,500 square feet in the southwest corner of the third floor. Business activity. Commercial property is leased with the intent that a certain type of activity will take place. Business activity is of particular importance in retail leasing, where the landlord wants to maintain an optimum mix of tenants. Some types of businesses, such as fast food restaurants, benefit from the presence of competitors, while others do not. Prohibited activities. The lease will also be specific regarding prohibited activities. Areas addressed would be activities that are a nuisance to neighbors, storage of dangerous or toxic materials, and prohibited business activity. Signage. A commercial tenant will want signage on the building, outdoor signs, and the lobby. The more space a tenant occupies, the more generous the signage allowance. Signage regulations also restrict the quality and placement of signs and advertisements, like flyers, placed on the property. Insurance. The lease should be specific on what the landlord and tenant will insure. The tenant will need insurance coverage for the contents and liability. Business interruption. The lease should address the issue of the property being unavailable or unusable because of damage from natural events, such as weather or man-made events, including terrorism. Possible provisions include the landlord's obligation to repair the premises and the tenant's obligations under the lease during the repair. The issue of condemnation must also be stipulated in the lease. Parking. The lease should address assigned parking and the number of guest parking spaces available to the tenant's customers. Escalation clauses. A landlord may be responsible for items such as taxes or utilities up to a certain rate or cost. The landlord's obligation is usually calculated on a base year. Rates above that may be passed through to the tenant. This type of provision protects the landlord from cost increases that may occur during a long-term lease. Common area use and maintenance. The tenant leases a specific space but may be responsible for the maintenance of common areas. Common areas include a building's lobby, parking lots, elevators, and landscape. Cooperative marketing. Retail centers often maintain a common fund that is used for center promotion that generates additional foot traffic. Assignment and sublet. A lease should stipulate the conditions under which the leased premises may be assigned or sublet. Any transfer to a new tenant should be subject to the landlord's approval, if allowed at all. Tenant and landlord obligations. The lease will contain default remedies if either party fails to comply with the terms of the lease. Tenant improvements. As a rule, all tenant improvements become the property of the landlord and must remain with the property when the tenant moves out. The lease will also stipulate that the landlord approves all tenant improvements and will be done with proper permits and according to applicable building codes. Maintenance. Both the landlord and the tenant have some obligation to maintain the premises. If the landlord fails to maintain the premises or fails to provide essential services, the tenant may have cause to terminate the lease under the concept of constructive eviction. Examples of constructive eviction include the failure of the landlord to provide heating or air conditioning, water or electricity, leaking roofs, and general decay of the premises that render it unusable can also justify early termination under constructive eviction. Right of first refusal. In a right of first refusal, a tenant has the right to match or better any offer the landlord may receive on the property before the property can be sold to someone else. A right of first refusal is not a lease purchase agreement or a lease with an option to buy, because the leased property is not currently for sale. However, if it should ever become available for purchase, the tenant has the right to bid on it. A matching offer from the tenant would secure the property for that tenant. Sale and leaseback. Business owners often own the real estate used in the business. The property could be any type, including office, retail, industrial, and others. Owning business facilities may appear to be a sound real estate investment. However, it does have a significant drawback, as considerable capital may be tied up in real estate that could otherwise be used to expand the business. For this and other reasons, the business will sell the property to an investor. They then lease back the property, usually on a long-term lease. The sale and leaseback then frees up the investor's capital. Discharge of leases. Leases are generally discharged at the end of their term, assuming that there are no further obligations on the part of the landlord or tenant, such as past due rents. As with most agreements, a lease may be discharged, terminated, by the mutual agreement of the parties. It is prudent that the discharge agreement be in writing and signed by both parties, landlord and tenant. A lease may be discharged under the concept of constructive eviction. Constructive eviction occurs when the landlord does something or fails to perform some obligation under the lease that renders the leased premises uninhabitable. Constructive eviction may occur because the landlord failed to maintain the roof or failed to provide water and/or sewer services to a unit. In most states, a tenant claiming constructive eviction must show that the tenant vacated the property on time. The failure or event cited was material enough to render the premises unusable or uninhabitable. The failure or event was the fault of the landlord and not some third party. The lease may be discharged as provided by law or the terms of the lease, including destruction of the property, condemnation, bankruptcy of the landlord, loss of access to the property, foreclosure, eviction. In most states, including Texas, an eviction is referred to as an action of forcible detainer. It is a legal process that allows the landlord to recover possession of a property when a tenant defaults on a lease. The most common default is the failure to pay rent. Assignment and sublet. An assignment of a lease occurs when a tenant's rights and liabilities are transferred to another. In most cases, the landlord reserves the right to approve the new tenant. The original tenant is no longer obligated under the lease when the assignment is complete. Some leases can be sublet. Subletting is the transfer of some or all of the tenant's rights and/or leased space to another, with liability remaining with the lessee. So, the sublessee pays rent to the lessee, who, in turn, pays the landlord. For example, a tenant may have a lease covering 15,000 square feet of office space. When they find that they no longer need all of the space, they might sublet 5,000 square feet to a new tenant. The key distinction between assignment and subletting is that assignment releases the original tenant from further obligations under the lease. Subletting does not. Termination. When a lease agreement comes to the end of the lease period, it is discharged and terminated. A tenant who fails to move out when the lease expires is known, among other things, as a holdover tenant. Holding over creates tenancy at sufferance if the holdover is not paying rent. A holdover tenancy is created if the holdover tenant is paying rent that is accepted by the landlord. Mutual rescission. Leases can also be terminated by the agreement of the parties. When a lease is terminated by the agreement of the parties, it is called mutual rescission. Option agreement. Option agreements are often used in real estate. An option agreement gives a potential buyer or tenant the right to purchase or lease a property. The option agreement is an example of a unilateral contract, a contract according to which only one of the parties is obligated to perform, unlike a sales agreement, which would require both parties to perform certain actions. It is important to recognize that an option agreement is not the same thing as a sales contract. The essential elements of an option agreement include the following. Term. The option to purchase is for a specific period. Price. The option is for a specific price, the option fee. Conditions. Other conditions of the proposed transaction are specified in the option agreement. An option to purchase is a standard tool in the commercial real estate business. For example, a developer may purchase an option to purchase from a seller while he or she is performing due diligence. Due diligence consists of the tasks performed to determine the feasibility of a proposed project. An option may be purchased that may give a potential developer up to a year or more to perform due diligence. In residential real estate, options are used on a short-term basis. In some states, short-term options are used to hold a property while the potential buyer is having inspections performed. In residential leasing, a tenant may have the option to purchase the property during the lease term. Lease option. A lease option allows a tenant to buy the property at a preset price and terms for a given period. This can also be called a lease with an option to buy. At the time the lease is negotiated, a purchase price is also negotiated. The tenant has the right to purchase the property at the preset price during the term of the lease. While the tenant is not obligated to buy, the landlord is obligated to sell. Brokers should refer clients interested in a lease purchase agreement to an attorney. License holders in Texas are specifically prohibited from writing this type of agreement for their clients. Due to the complexity of option agreements, they are most often prepared by an attorney. In Texas, there are no standard TREC forms for option agreements. In order to avoid the unlawful practice of law by license holders, option agreements should be prepared by an attorney. Contract for deed. Another contract used in real estate is the contract for deed. A typical sale of a property concludes with the transfer of title to the buyer at closing. The closing usually occurs anywhere from 20 to 60 days after entering into a contract. Another method of selling real estate that postpones the delivery of title into the future is accomplished with a contract for deed. Historically, most seller finance transactions were done using a contract for deed. A contract for deed, also known as an installment contract, land contract, or real estate contract, is a contract between a buyer and seller. In the contract, the buyer agrees to make regular payments to the seller. The seller retains legal title to the property, known as title retention, and the buyer acquires equitable title or equitable interest in the property. In the contract, the seller promises to convey legal title to the buyer when all payments have been made. In many cases, the buyer is unable to obtain traditional mortgage credit and may or may not have made a down payment. Contract for deed has historically been used in a wide variety of transactions. Seller finance of a residence for a buyer whose financial or credit situation makes getting a new loan impossible. Historically, buyers under a contract for deed had rights that were little more than those of a tenant. When the buyer defaulted, his or her eviction was a relatively easy process. Seller finance of a residence that has an existing mortgage that cannot be paid off. The sale of development tracts where the developer has a mortgage on the entire project that does not allow for releases of individual tracts. Contract for deed transactions are inexpensive, quick, and easy. Because a lender is not involved, and because title does not transfer, the deal is closed quickly, often without the benefit of the services of a title company or title insurance. The sale of property using a contract for deed involves risk for both the seller and the buyer. If the buyer fails to make timely payments to the seller may have difficulty clearing the title record after repossession of the property. This is especially true if the buyer records the contract in the public records. The risk to the buyer is even greater. The buyer might make on-time payments for years, only to find that the seller is incapable of delivering clear title in the future due to circumstances that are out of the seller's control. For example, the seller might be bankrupt, encumbered by judgments, or might even be deceased. Some unscrupulous sellers have been known to mortgage the property without the buyer's knowledge. The buyer is unaware of the mortgage until he loses the property in foreclosure. The sale of lots and small acreage tracts on contract for deed is also quite risky for a buyer. In most cases, the developer is the borrower on a mortgage that encumbers the entire development. The developer sells tracts to buyers who enter into a contract for deed. The buyer anticipates being deeded the property when all payments have been made. However, if the developer has failed to sell enough parcels to pay off the development loan, the seller cannot deliver clear title. Additionally, if the developer fails to repay the development loan, the entire project will be foreclosed. At that point, all of the buyers lose the land, the money paid under the contract, and any improvements they may have made to the land. Some states prohibit the use of a contract for deed, while others severely restrict its use. In many of the states where the practice is still legal, safeguards have been put in place that protect the buyer from being easily evicted from a property upon default. Selling and financing property on a contract for deed is still legal in Texas. Since 1999, the state has enacted legislation to protect buyers, especially in the case of buyers who have, over time, made a substantial number of payments. There are no TREC promulgated forms for selling property on a contract for deed. License holders should refer buyers and sellers to an attorney when the parties want to sell on this form of contract. Contract for deed is also known as a land contract, installment contract, cash for deed, and real estate contract. Lease purchase agreements. A lease purchase agreement is a contract used in real estate that combines some of the elements of a sale with a lease. A tenant makes regular lease payments to the landlord, just as in a standard lease in a lease purchase, the tenant agrees to purchase the property at an agreed-upon time and terms. The obligation of the tenant to purchase the property makes this type of transaction completely different from a lease option agreement. In a lease option agreement, the buyer has the option to buy, but is not obligated to do so. Although not required in some cases, a part of the buyer's or tenant's rent payments are applied to the down payment or purchase price. The lease purchase agreement is advantageous to the seller who may be trying to sell a property in a down market. The arrangement also appeals to the buyer, whose credit or personal situation makes it difficult or impossible to obtain a mortgage. If the ultimate sale involves the buyer obtaining a mortgage loan for the purchase, the risk to both parties is that the loan may not be attainable. In most cases, the buyer will be subject to a loss of earnest money or other damages if he or she fails to close. In many cases, the lease option is more advantageous to the buyer because the buyer has the right to purchase but is not obligated to do so. In Texas, TREC has no standard promulgated contract forms for lease purchase agreements. Texas license holders with buyers and sellers who wish to enter into this type of agreement should refer them to an attorney. License holders should never write language that merges a TREC promulgated contract with a lease form that attempts to create a lease purchase agreement.